We have a very interesting lecture ahead of us today. Let me say, as I always do, that if you haven't already done so, you can show your affection to the Vancouver Institute by picking up a membership outside. It's voluntary, extremely inexpensive, best bargain going, and we urge people to be members. So many of you do, and I won't, perhaps shouldn't have to repeat this lesson very often. This is not Channel 9, but we will still welcome members who help us to bring the kind of talks that on which the Institute thrives. Today, we have a lecture brought to us by the Delgrau Memorial Lectures, and it's Koichiro Fujikura, who straddles the Pacific Ocean, or at least jumps across it very often from Japan to America. He has received his early education after he emerged from Osaka. He received it in Japan, but he also then went to Amherst and got a master's degree at Harvard. We seem to have a plethora of Harvard speakers, but he has been a visiting lecturer at many institutions in the United States, and has also been associated with as a professor and dean at Toshisha University, and also at the University of Tokyo in Japan. He has been talking in general about Japanese environmental law and policy under the Delgrauer lectures, and there are, as you know, many problems with the environment in Japan, but one problem that they don't have is they don't have too many lawyers. They have only one lawyer for every 8,000 people. We have one for every 350. And so that pollution problem does not exist in Japan. And so he is therefore a very rare kind of person, a prestigious lawyer originating from Japan. And he's going to talk to us tonight on the subject of what can we return to Earth, Japanese pollution experiences. Koichiro Fujikura, please welcome him.
Thank you very much, Professor Bolt. It's wonderful to be back to Vancouver again, one of the my favorite city. When I received invitation to be a part of this distinguished Delgrauer Memorial Lectureship, I saw a list of distinguished lecturers so far, and I was, of course, awed and honored. It was quite a challenge to come here to speak in English. I have learned that Mr. Delgrauer was a distinguished scholar, educator, lawyer, and business person, and outstanding civic leader. And after reading his biography, I decided I should take this challenge. And thank you very much for this opportunity. And I face this wonderful audience here, and I'll try to relate some of our pollution experience in Japan. By the way, I have several friends in Vancouver. I would particularly like to mention Jonathan Baker. he's here tonight, and I suspect he's been instrumental for getting me here tonight. Jonathan and I was a classmate at Amherst College, and he's been a very good friend. When I arrived Vancouver, a bit tense to face this, Sherry Keating, Keith Keating, and John, and Jonathan Baker, and Dominic made me immediately feel welcome and feel at home. And I thank you very much for that. Now, topic I would like to speak tonight, we, of course, as you know, went through many terrible pollution problems. It's really started 100 some years ago when Japan decided to open the country. And opening country, we sought a possible model to adopt. And several missions are sent to Europe, North America, England, and they came back with various ideas about possible models we should adopt. I'm a lawyer, and legally we adopted the model based upon French and Germany. So we have continental legal system in Japan. But more than that, mission came back with the idea, really, we needed to start industrializing and build the nation. So from the beginning of Meiji, almost 130 years ago, Japan pursued this goal of industrialization almost single-mindedly and at all costs. It continued until the time that we went into the Second World War. And as you know, we were completely destroyed during the war. And after the war, this goal of industrialization still persisted. We have to rebuild our industries, major industries, almost totally destroyed. And we worked hard to rebuild the nation. In the process, we paid a price for this single-minded pursuit of industrialization. As you know, Japan is a very small country with 1,250,000, am I right? 125 million, that's right. Excuse me. All crowded into very limited space. You visualize a size of country. I was told Japan is just about same size of state of Montana in the United States. Now, 80% or close of our land is mountainous. So that leaves about 20-25% of a space for us to live, 125 million. Now, given this limited space and density of population, and there you have a very intensive industrial activities, then what we get is pollution. This is so obvious, of course, in retrospect, it's so obvious. But it was almost inevitable that we have very severe pollution. We paid price dearly in terms of human sufferings, loss of health, and lives. And this is a story that I'm going to relate tonight. I'll take this example of mercury poisoning, which happened in the southernmost island of Japan, four islands, Kyushu. And this is the story about what happened to a small fishing village called Minamata back in 1950s, mid-1950s. Let me introduce to this village by showing just a couple of pictures. Let me personalize a little bit. I grew up in a fishing village in Shikoku, which is in the smallest of four main islands in Japan, very much like this Minamata, almost identical. It's peaceful, beautiful, and abundance of fish. I went out fishing on a boat like this many times. So when it happened in 1950s, and it really became a focus of national attention late 1960s, early 70s, I really felt that I might not be guilty, but I felt somehow responsible for letting this happen to the people there. It was a mercury poisoning caused by discharged water in the bay coming from one particular plant, a company called Chisso, which had been operating there for about 40 years before the war, and they made fertilizers. In the process, they used mercury as a catalytic agent in the production process. They were very careless of treating this mercury, and they have discharged, they dumped actually, several hundred tons of mercury over the years into the bay. mercury accumulated in the sedimentation, the bottom of the sea. Fish fed on it, shellfish. And strange thing began to happen around 1955-6. Large birds like crow and hawks suddenly dropped from the sky, dead. Dead fish started floating on the surface. Then cats started dancing and run around circle, jumped in the sea and drowned. Cats simply disappeared. All the cats in the village disappeared. Then people, 1956, first group or wave of victims were brought into hospital. Doctor could not diagnose what they are suffering from. So, cause unknown, they are feared as having contagious or communicable disease. So patients and their families are segregated and discriminated against from the rest of the community. It took almost 10 years for the team of scientists and doctors to identify the cause of the disease as a mercury. And mercury was coming from this particular plant. Mercury poisoning is not a new disease. You can go back to history, and I was told that actually there is a passage in Alice in Wonderland phrase, he's as mad as Hatter. And naturally, Hatter used mercury to treat the material to make hot. And mercury got into their body system from their fingertips. And they had this disease for long time ago, but nobody made connection back in 1950s. And of course, nobody really made any connections or identified this mercury poisoning coming from food chain, not directly from touching mercury, but it's gradually built up in the body of fish, and then people ate it. And mercury, when you take it in, it really affects the central nervous system. So patient lost the control of their body movement. Hands and feet shakes violently, and you cannot control it. But after about 8-10 years, cause was identified. And finally, after 12 years since first patients or victims hospitalized, government finally made official announcement that this is a mercury poisoning disease caused by industrial activities, pollution caused disease. Now, victim sued, and there is a role for the lawyers in Japan. But this came only after victim exhausted all sorts of traditional means for settling disputes. For those 10, 12 years, they wanted to negotiate with Chisso Company to shut off their discharge, because instinctively, all these fishermen around the area knew that the cause of this strange disease, whatever it is coming from this plant. It's only plant in the area. Fishermen saw a dark, ominous color, discharged water coming from directly the end of the discharged pipe of the plant. So they really wanted to negotiate, wanted to shut this discharge pipe, but company just refused. Victims demonstrated, staged sit-in in front of the company gate for many days. They asked local government to mediate and conciliate without really getting any concrete results. So finally, they sued in 1969. And after the trial, their claims were vindicated. The court awarded substantial damage for victims. And company finally agreed to shut down this, or actually government ordered the plant to cease the discharge of this mercury tainted water. But damage was done. And compensation that the victim got, or damage award the victim got, really did not solve any problem. Against this background, Japanese government, the Diet, met in rather emergency fashion in 1970 and passed several basic environmental protection legislation: water quality, air quality, soil, and subsidences, noise, and all sorts of regulatory standards are set around that time. But to the people of Minamata, damage was done. One of the major legislation provided administrative system of compensation for the victims of pollution. Now, it's awful term, I mean, victims of pollution, which meant that people suffering from source-specific pollution, like Minamata, mercury is the agent. And for the victims who are living in highly industrial areas where air is really polluted. And at that time, sulfur dioxide, SOx, was a major problem. So people living in large industrial complex, many stacks and yellow smokes coming out, they were suffering from asthmas and bronchitis and so forth. So under this compensation scheme, about 50 areas of highly polluted section in Japan was so disagonated. And after you live there for 2-3 years, and when you develop this prescribed symptom, cough, you go to a doctor, and doctor certify you as suffering from air pollution. Then you are entitled to receive medical expenses and loss of wages and so forth. But first, you have to be certified. This air pollution victims certification was abolished several years ago because air quality of these 50 sections of all over the country improved. It is said, well, it is true, sulfur dioxide level really went down, but we don't know about NOx. And I suspect it's doing as much harm as SOx to the people, but scientifically, there is not certain proof. So those areas, as far as air pollution are concerned, decertified, were designated. That means no more polluted area, officially, no more polluted area. But source-specific pollutions like Minamata is still there. And this system, what this system did is to provide compensation for the victims of pollution source-certified. Now, there are about 20,000 people in Minamata area and along the sea around there are affected. Patients suffering from some symptom. About 1,200 people died. About 17,000 have applied for certification. Now it's a administrative nightmare to process these applications. But problem is more basic. When mercury poisoning victims came to hospital, they are the cases of very acute mercury poisoning. So doctor could easily diagnose and find that they are suffering from mercury poisoning. But as year goes by and the mercury spread, and intake level of mercury goes down, doctors found it very difficult to agree on a typical symptom of mercury poisoning. People may be shaking, but it may be from old age or some other causes. People may lose sure foot, but that may be from other cause. So certification and clear standard for certifying mercury victims has been a problem. About 17,000 people applied for certification. To the present time, only 2,500 people certified. Now you are certified, you are entitled, as I said, to receive medical expenses and loss of wage and so forth. It's sort of medical expenses plus living expenses type of compensation, amount of which is just about $2,000, Canadian dollars. I just found out today that one Canadian dollars is 100 yen, Japanese. So it's very easy to convert. But anyway, about $2,000 a month, 24,000 a year compensation being paid. Well, when this compensation system was designed, it was hoped that this system serves several different functions. One is to provide, of course, compensation to the victims. Of course, it's much needed. They immediately have to account for out-of-pocket expenses, for medical bills and so forth. If they cannot work, then their incomes has to be somehow supplemented. So one function is to compensate victims quickly without going to the court to establish their claim. Second function is by certifying victims, system hoped to identify the extent of harms and where it is happening. So identification of harms in very early stage, because victim under this system was given incentive to come forward to be identified. But it's awful thing to be identified as a officially certified victims of pollution. And many people resented that and never came forth to be identified. So to this day, we don't know exactly how many people were actually suffering or the extent of pollution harms in the area. But anyway, still about 2,500 people are on this list. And third function of this compensation scheme is that it is legitimize the payment of compensation to the victims, because this is a system set up by law, so payment to the victim is perfectly legitimate thing. When victims of Minamata went to the court for the first time, there was a criticism that they are claiming something without basis or without justification, and they were discriminated for that too. So legitimization of this compensation was third function. Fourth function would be to put this cost on the shoulder of polluter. So Chisso company is paying for all this compensation necessary under the system. And there is every reason for Chisso and also political, in a political sense, for the government to control the increase of certified victims. I don't know if I can say that the certification process has been controlled politically, But when you see the number of applications approved over years, you can see a clear sort of graph. Some years it's up and some years are quite down, and it's quite uneven. And when you describe political situations each year under the this graph, you can almost make some connections of what happening in political stage and number of victims certified. Anyway, Chisso has been made to pay, so polluter must pay principle in action. Those are the functions that compensation scheme designed for, but couple other interesting and more important functions are there, which is, one of which is that the system really generate necessary information about the extent of harms done in environmental field in terms of human health. Under the system, we know exactly how many people are certified, how many applied, how much have been paid out, and how much were imposed upon Chisso to pay. And naturally, certifying victims gave opportunity for the victim to organize as a political force. And as long as you have this certified group of people as a pollution victims in your society, it is often difficult for the government and for business people to argue to relax the regulatory standard. So there is a political functions under the system sort of created, but for the reason I will relate later, I don't think this has been very effective. Now, a couple more slides. This is a deformed hands of the victims affected by mercury. This is a picture taken by Eugene Smith, a mother giving a birth to her child affected by mercury. This child died. Now, there are several lessons to be learn from this experience, and I'll speak about these lessons. To us Japanese, it was certainly a major national tragedy, and this happens to be 40th year since the first victims were identified. What is happening in Minamata right now is that when I visited there a couple of times last year, now, mouth of bay, Minamata Bay, was closed by steel net. It's like a anti-submarine net so that fish cannot go out. And all these years, fishermen are still catching fish in the bay, but they cannot sell. So they'll bring them to Chisso Company, and company had to buy them. But no use. I mean, they dump into large cans and mixed with concrete and dispose. Chisso is still there, operating. But only reason for their operation is to continue to pay out compensation to the victims. Of course, they cannot do it on their own, really, although they diversified and branched out in many other areas. And I understand some of their operations, totally unrelated from Minamata, were profitable. Prefectural government made several low interest loans to keep this Chisso company afloat. So they are still there operating. Major portion of the bay has been filled. This is the area of the bay, and this portion in the middle are the sections filled with dirt and land transported from nearby area. Bottom of it, a several feet of sedimentation heavily contaminated by mercury. And some of them are drained into this area. Scientists found that there is no way to remove mercury. So landfill was only alternative. Large space was created there, and now people are talking about a possible use of this open space. One museum of Minamata disease was built there, but rest of the open space were unused. There is some talk about building park. I hope it is not industrial park, but some bamboos and the trees are planted. Space about 56 hectares. I don't know what the equivalence in terms of acres, but you adopted the metric system. I wouldn't worry about it. Space is there, and the use of that is still undecided. But I personally think it should be kept that way, just that way, as a sort of monument or grave for all those sufferings. People died, fish died, bird dies, and cat died. Compensation, and that about only thing we could do, and especially in legal sense, when damage is done, there's no other way but provide money. But compensation scheme may have served several functions I mentioned, but it proved very divisive to the community and people there, because some people have sued, some didn't. Some people have applied for certification, some didn't. Some got money, some didn't. So there are a rather uneasy feeling among the people, mostly fishermen in the village. Indeed, there are 20 different factions there about the way that government should provide help and compensation and so forth. So this just paying money to the people and victims are very divisive to the community. We can draw some anatomy of this pollution, because it is really a prototype of every pollution in Japan. There is on one side, unorganized, unresourceful, and scattered around fishermen along the sea coast, as against very resourceful and powerful industrial company, which really controlled Minamata City. Company officials also served as a councilman for the city. So it's really almost, you can say, a company town. And in this situation, it was very difficult for the victims to stand up against this company, even they are suffering this grave injury. It was a local happening, many hundred miles away from the central government in Tokyo. So there is this structure of local happening, politicians in the central government or bureaucrats paying not much attention, unconcerned, uncaring, and the situation was left for many years. And there is a basic point that very basic civil rights, in a very fundamental sense, were violated. And of course they resorted to the court, and the court vindicated. However, only way we could do something about it is simply provide money. And it was not enough. Maintain ecosystem which is important to his to its local community, and harm caused by industrial activities can be detected and best be detected by people who are living close to it. I would really like to see the ecosystem in a global sense, or in international sense, be protected. But I don't think we yet to have a solid scientific basis to design whatever system which is best or protect ecosystem. So we must start with a localized ecosystem. Fish we eat every day, whether it is safe, the way they are farmed, the way they are caught, is very important. And if we could devise or somehow control the system we have in a sense that it is least injurious or damaging to the environment, the better. And the place to start, I think, is in ourselves, in our family, town, village, county, then country, nation, region, maybe. But we really need a basic information and scientific knowledges on which we can build on and design this type of system. And in Japan, we still do not have a system like this. Main obstacle I see is a sort of closed organization, denied access by public to those industrial activities, government decision making, and well, we really need a Freedom of Information Act. We've been talking about it for the last 20 years. We haven't got it. We are talking about public access to and the participation in the decision making on the part of the government, and even by private industries affecting environment around the citizen. I don't think we have made much progress in this respect. Japan, as you know, is still traditionally very closed society. Many things are decided on consensus basis among people immediately involved or people who has a direct interest in. Outsiders who are not invited into this consensus forming process is totally outside, and there is no way really to get access to. In order to make any sort of intelligent decisions, and decisions which values ecosystem or sub-ecosystem, we need information. And those things are going to be a major issues and concerns for us Japanese. Well, I will stop here, and I'd be just happy to respond any questions you might have. Thank you very much.
We'll have our usual question period. I'll ask people to ask short, simple questions, not to make comments, and we also will not invite people who want to change Canadian dollars for 100 yen to come forward. But please, could we have questions then? Peter, first?
You mentioned the 2,500 certified victims that receive compensation for their medical expenses and their lost wages. Under Japanese law, are they entitled to any other types of compensation?
Could you repeat the question?
Well, if victims are entitled any other compensation than the medical expenses and living sort of allowance. Well, yes, there is a pain and suffering award, lump sum, when they are first certified, and the first payment includes their pain and suffering and legal interests accumulated since the time their application was filed, and it usual case that it certification process took 5, 6, 8, 10 years. So this accumulation of interest can be substantial. And they, well, depending on the case and depending of the severity of disabledness from mercury, amount varies. But this lump sum payment given to the victims when they are certified can be around $2,400,000, Canadian dollars.
Yeah. We'll have one back there, and then we'll come forward.
Are there any Japanese environmental laws which could be applied to Canadian legal systems that could benefit, you know, Canadian environment? Are there any successes from this lesson?
Well, is there any environmental regulation which can be successfully applied to Canadian environmental problem? Well, that's a difficult question, and I'm not sure I'm really qualified to answer that. We don't really, well, in technical sense, we are not concerned with extraterritorial application of domestic legislation. That's a standard answer law professor could give to the student. You are not a student. But unique kind of legislation, if we had one, is this a compensation scheme? And I don't know if it makes any sense to Canadian situation, but it helped to identify the injuries and harms. It put cost on the part of polluter. But again, this compensation approach at the same time creates many problems, especially before you compensate, you have to somehow identify victims and certify they are deserving compensation. And unless you have a very clear standard for certification, the process will break down. So I don't think this is a system can be recommended in any sense. But prevention is really important. And once damage done, there is simply nothing you can pay, you can do except provide money.
Next question over here.
Yes. Well, given this increasing globalization, this compensation could be provided for people outside of Japanese jurisdiction or for future generations. Well, we haven't done that so far. And we are not creating fund for future generation either. But harm we have already done affect people outside of Japan as well as future generation. And I'm sure in some way we have to account for this. So far, nobody come up with any reasonable or sensible or practical scheme to do this.
Robert?
I'd like to ask, you would say that I'm not a scientist, why is it so difficult to deal with the causes of the poisoning in the first place? And what do you hope can be done?
Well, I don't know. In retrospect, it took 8 years, really, for the team of scientists and doctors to identify this food chain mercury move and cause of this virulent disease. Part of it, I'm sure, is a uncooperating attitude on the part of the polluter. They never revealed any information about production, their production process, the amount of mercury they used and dumped, or any other chemical they've been using. Actually, it was difficult, very difficult for the victims to even get a plant map, or even go inside to the plant and get some samples. So that really hindered the effort to identify cause. I certainly hope that more access to the industrial activities affecting environment is created, and more information, it is more easy to identify the cause.
But maybe there's another side to that question. It is the question now of the difficulty of certification, and I would have thought that one could routinely measure the mercury levels of the patients applying for certification, and that would be a rather straightforward way of deciding who should receive it.
Well, mercury, as I understand it, stays in various parts of your body, depending on the situation, depending on the type of diet you have. Hair contents was used often as a sure indicator of accumulation. But even there, depending on the ear, and so forth, that cannot be a standard for identification. And also, victims who are applying after going through several medical examinations, they just fed up and give up and refuse to cooperate.
Question back there.
Was the company prohibited from assignment in bankruptcy? I think if I were
repeat the question.
Could
the company Chisso apply for Chapter 11 or bankruptcy proceeding? Well, I'm sure they wish they could, but politically, it is out of their option, because now community and the society in general see Chisso, the polluter, and it would be a suicide anyway for the company to file for bankruptcy. and maybe society would be outraged if they do, they did. Which really means that nobody can afford to see Chisso bankrupt. Well, if certified victims expect that their compensation continue, government is in no position to say that, well, we'll pay. So, legally, I think Chisso is eligible for applying bankruptcy proceedings, but their board of directors have not decided that they should do that. So.
Yes. We have a question over here.
When Japan signs an international treaty like the Treaty on Global
Warming,
does that become law in Japan? Does Parliament make it a law?
Sure, surely. Japan is signatory, yes, Japan is signatory to almost all major environmental protection treaties. Question is that, is Japan implementing it domestically? Yes. We are very faithful in legal sense to legislate necessary implementation statutes after signing every major environmental treaty, protection treaties. But whether it is effectively being enforced is entirely different matter. Entirely different matter.
Question over there, and then we're over there.
Yes.
This here? Yes.
Hello?
Yes. Liberalization of government?
Oh, freedom of information.
Oh, freedom of information.
Is society changing?
I certainly would like to think so. Change cannot come overnight, but we are changing. And this type of experience really affects the general awareness on the part of the public. And through this experience, many people now see that we really need to reform the way we have been doing. More openness, more transparency on the part of our government, accountability on the part of the public officials. Sure, many people see it, but to translate these wishes in terms of vote and finding good political parties to represent, there we have a problem.
And worse yet, the corporate government liaison.
Yes. Close relations with the regulated and regulators. Yes, they are all there.
Okay, over there.
You describe a process for setting environmental standards.
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 Standards Surely, one lesson clearly from these experiences, prevention counts, and prevention is much more important than paying for damages. And regulatory standards, emissions and ambient were set there, and some of them are really rigorously enforced. Now, process of standard setting is still deep within a responsible bureaucracy. We don't have this administrative rule-making procedures and public access to these procedures like in the United States. So standards, whatever comes out as a final result, in some cases may be a result of consultation, consensus building between the government and the regulated industries, very little input from citizens' group, but they are out, and some emission standards and ambient standards are rather strict, and some are effective.
Behind the bar over there, you've been waiting.
Yes. Yes. You are perfectly right that our pollution problem nowadays are from consumption, and every citizen in this sense is responsible. Now, interesting impact of international treaty we signed, recent one is the London Convention on Ocean Dumping. And we faithfully legislated implementing legislation. And we comply with this deadline, ceasing all ocean dumping as the January 1st of this year. Before that, we've been dumping many so-called non-toxic substances into five areas around Japan, sea, Pacific Ocean too. Now, government had to stop that. So there is really no way for garbage, construction waste, non-organic chemical waste, and toxic chemical waste to go. And we do have this space problem to build waste treatment facilities or dumping sites. And this has been a major domestic issue. And there again, I see the, in order to make a sensible site locations, designs for waste disposing site, we really need a opinion of a citizen reflected upon this process. We haven't really yet devised a sensible way of forming new consensus. our court has a very strict standard requirement for standing to sue. So it is not easy at all for ordinary citizens to go to the court and demand that particular decision-making process relating to waste disposals be open to public. We really need the transparency and public, wider public participation in this problem.
I'll choose two more questions. One way back there, and then one here.
Well, harmfulness of mercury has been long recognized and established in Japan, surely. But the trouble with this case was that it was really the first instance that mercury get into the food chain and methyl mercury turned into organic mercury in the process. And to identify this change in mercury and the way it get into the human body was very difficult for scientists to follow. That's why it took 8 years, almost 10 years, before they came out with final report. I hope from now on this report can be useful for other nations too.
But the question was really about the impact that this has had on dental amalgams. You know, dentists use mercury for fixing teeth. And since you were among the first in the world to recognize Minamata disease, you were, has this had an impact now on changing dental practices?
I'm not aware of. I have many dentist friends, but they never talked about this problem.
Yes, it is under discussion here, and I think partly as a result of the
Well, then it will be in Japan tomorrow.
Well, only one short question here.
I'm a little bit concerned about an environmental suit that seems to be on the stove. I'm referring to export of technology from Japan to a country where the government is extremely corrupt and is in desperate need of technical assistance. I'm referring to Eastern Siberia. Vladivostok is full of Japanese who are trying to sell something.
What's the question?
The question is there any control of these exporters and businessmen who are going to these countries that have no proper government?
Well,
the question?
Yes. Is there any regulations on the part of government, Japanese government, on the exporting pollution, let's say? Yes. No. Statutory, there is no basis for the government to do. And government could certainly exercise discretion or discretionary judgment or administrative guidance, we call it, calling the exporters into the office and say, this is dangerous, this is toxic, you shouldn't do this and that, otherwise we wouldn't grant permits next time. This time maybe, but next time you wouldn't get it. So that's a sort of a control. But among industrial societies, they three, 4 years ago, adopted the guidelines for their overseas activities. I hope they are really following it.
Okay.
No, that's
just one. Sorry. I think in winding up the evening now, I have two happy tasks. One is to again encourage you to be friendly to the people at the membership desk outside as you leave. And the second happy task is to ask Jonathan Baker, a very old friend of our speaker, to thank him for the talk that he gave today.
Dr. Fujikura, as you were speaking, I was remembering back in those days in 1958 when you had black hair and I had hair, and thinking of the days in our dormitory and trying to imagine that if someone had said that 30 years in the future, I would be in a city that I had never heard of at that time and would have arranged for you to come about to speak of experiences relating to pollution, no one would have believed it. But what would have been really incredible is the fact that that kid down the hall, who was the genetics student named David Suzuki, would have, a week before you arrived, produced a report relating to fish pollution. I would only note that there are certain ironies in life that we can't explain. On behalf of the Dow Grauer Foundation, I want to thank you for a very great lecture. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Come early next week. We have a wonderful evening with Mary Pratt, and there will be a big crowd. Yes.